for February 8th. We will begin with a presentation by Linda Ames.
Good morning, I'm Linda Ames with Budget and Manage Division, and today I'm wearing my hat as staff person to the School Revenue Forecast Committee. So I'm going to go through this little presentation, an overview of what that committee is and what we do, and then actually go through some of the numbers and cost drivers for calculating the state school fund numbers. On page 2, the School Revenue Forecast Committee was to be established by the Department of Administrative Services back in 1999 by executive order under the previous governor, and that does continue. The committee was directed to annually forecast general operating revenue that can reasonably be expected by K-12 education districts for each of the following 3 years. So you can see the language is fairly broad, and we've interpreted that in two ways, really. One is, what is the cost in the next biennium to continue current program? And the second is, then, how do we incorporate revenue constraints in times like this, which in this round essentially was the governor's budget. So I'll talk a little bit about each of those sets of numbers. And then the charge was to account for real costs, changes in cost of personnel, other services and supplies. And the impetus was to get a more realistic roll-up for K-12 rather than just applying a standard inflation factor, which is how it had been done in the past. So the last forecast was made on December 1st. It did include the sort of essential budget level, or that continuing program level calculation, and the governor's budget level, which incorporated the shortfalls. Page 3, I think really there's 3 major purposes, although they may not all be explicitly expressed in the executive order. One is to develop a more data-driven methodology that is more realistic for what it costs next biennium to continue current program. And here I want to emphasize that this is really a technical process. This is about data, about forecasting, about developing the data sets and methodologies to do a better job with this. It's an evolving process. We started with rather little data in some cases back in 99, and we've come a long way. In particular, as the Department of Education has moved more of their resources to be too analytical, to analysis and research. I also want to emphasize all it does is look at what it costs to continue current program. If we have ratcheted down our funding level, like we have biennium after biennium, we're still only looking very narrowly at what it costs next biennium to do what we did this year. We are not making any sort of judgments about where we want our funding to be. This is the technical piece. So the quality ed model, which you'll hear about later, combines, sort of starts with this piece, but goes on and does a lot more analysis of how do we want our system to look. The second point, to provide information to districts to assist them in budgeting. I would say in our current climate, where we're always waiting for the next ballot measure and a lot of uncertainty about funding, we have probably not been as successful in that particular mission in the last couple of years. There actually were times when the School Revenue Forecast Committee chose not to release a forecast out to districts because it was like, what do we tell them? Do we assume we have the money that's going to pass, or do we assume this ballot measure fails, et cetera? And thirdly, to provide a forum where a broad array of constituencies interested in the K-12 budget have some input into the process, and especially have an understanding of the data, the assumptions, and the calculations. And the idea is that the discussion can be more informed and less political. It certainly doesn't mean that all the players that you see on the next page agree that this is the right funding level for K-12. It just means that all these people understand what went into it and what it means, and therefore can better communicate why it is or isn't an adequate level of funding. So you see on page 4 the members of the committee. We always have 2 legislative members, and of course with our chair here, that does help to communicate the information. And then you'll see like Lori Wimmer Whalen, Kent Hunsaker, John Marshall, 3 of the major organizations involved in K-12 funding issues. And then the last 3, Steve Meyer from Legislative Revenues, Sue here from Legislative Fiscal, Brian Reeder from the Department of Ed, are more the technical group. And a lot of the data work is actually done by those technical folks, as well as bringing in experts from various agencies to work on specific forecasts, including other Department of Ed folks, the state economist, the state demographer. Both OSBA and OEA have been very helpful on sharing their data on contract information and health benefit increases in those contracts. We also do the forecast of local revenues, property taxes, so we get the assessors involved in the Department of Revenue for that work. In terms of process, then the committee made its last forecast December 1, so using data that was available in the fall. But keep in mind that as we progress through the session, that various other data will become available, will be improved. We will update the data then before you make final funding decisions in the spring. And typically legislative revenue and legislative fiscal kind of take the lead in making sure all of those updates get made. And for instance, I think today the land board will announce that there'll be an increase above what we forecast in the Common School Fund distribution for next year. So those are the kind of things we would like to see getting updated as we go into the spring.
Ms. Sames, not that we're looking for every dollar, but any prognosis on what they will forecast?
In our forecast for next year, we assume $16 million, which is sort of their minimum distribution. And because the stock market did so great, they actually will distribute the maximum, and it's about $45 million, so a gain of roughly $29, $30 million. Actually, a pretty good chunk.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can use that.
But the one thing to remember is all of the updates will be done as we take a new look at it, and sometimes other things go down, so I try not to get too excited about the ups till we've looked at all of the pieces.
We didn't
want to
hear that.
Yeah. we kind of look at it, you know. You said 25 to 30, did you say?
29 or 30.
29, 30.
More
I'll just go 30. And then I'll just add 40 for the forecast. That'll give us 70. And then we'll go 112 down with the court decision.
Greg Walden's forest.
Yeah.
Payment in lieu of tax. That might be another, what was that, $30 million last year?
Yeah. We might get back. If the Supreme Court decides we have to pay back the $112 million, we might get back to equal. Please proceed.
Okay. Then on page 5, I'll actually go through some of the key funding cost driver issues. The basic question, we know what level of funding we're providing schools this year, and once we consider the various cost drivers, like health benefits, like PERS, then what will it cost in 05-06 and 06-07 to provide that same program level? So the first issue is, what really is the funding level this year? It's a little less obvious this time than some. First of all, we consider both state and local revenues. So we consider the property tax and part of the calculation. And second of all, we do annual calculations, since that is how the school budgets are built, which is unlike most state agencies where they manage over a biennium. What we have assumed in the committee forecast is that schools actually spread their ballot measure 30 cuts over the 2 years this biennium, partly because they got their funding level so late, many of them had actually budgeted for that first year at a lower level than we ended up funding them, so they sort of already had taken part of those cuts in effect. Other schools just thought that they needed to be conservative in their estimates, knowing ballot measure 30 was going to be voted on in the winter, and planned on reserves in case that didn't pass. So what, and most of this came out of a survey that was done out of the Senate President's office that Sue had done some work on. Each school had their own situation, and that was expressed in those surveys, but when you looked at it overall, it did appear that most schools essentially spread those cuts over the 2 years. And so what that means is they had a slightly higher funding level in 2004-05 because they took some of the cuts already in 2003-04. So that was the base that we rolled off of. Then probably the main cost driver, teacher salary growth, or one of the keys. In this particular year, it isn't necessarily the biggest dollar cost driver. This is based on a Department of Ed model using individual teacher data that they collect each year. The model actually forecasts average teacher salary for each year for statewide. And this measure really incorporates three components. For teachers that are coming back from the previous year, that includes the cost of COLAs and step increases for the teachers that get steps. But that average teacher salary measure also includes the savings that you get from turnover, as we've had a high number of retirements. And teacher salaries are, salary schedules are unique and very different than state agency salary schedules, for instance, in that they have about 20 steps. So when a teacher at the top step retires and is replaced with a teacher closer to the bottom steps, there's quite a significant savings. And in the last few years, schools have experienced fairly significant savings
There might be one caveat to that, and that is that because of cuts, many school districts have probably been in the choice of the teacher retiring and not replacing the teacher.
Chair Dunworth, exactly. And in last year's data, we think we see that in the data,
yes,
that we didn't actually get the turnover savings that the model was originally predicting because we weren't replacing the teachers. So generally, what the model is showing is that teacher salary growth is very modest by historic standards. For instance, in the current year in 2004-05, the total increase in average teacher salary we're forecasting at 1.2%, and that's less than half of the average over the last 8 years. But what we're seeing as we forecast out into 2006 and 2007 is a moderating of that, of those savings from turnover, as the retirement boom is probably over, and we still have demographics that indicate that retirements will continue, but we're not going to have that big bubble that we've had the last couple of years. So those costs will start to go up. Other salaries, mainly the classified staff, we use just simple trending with cost of living adjustments. And then health benefits, which this time was a really big cost driver, as there's a lot of pressure on health benefits. One of the difficulties of looking at these forecasts is that salaries and benefits are really part of a package that's bargained. And for instance, in the Portland School District contract this time, they made an explicit choice to reduce benefits but increase the cost of living steps, the salary piece of the package. We're trying to look at them separately here, but in reality, they're a combined package.
Thank you.
We're estimating that the increase in the cost to the district is 12% per year, and that is assuming that part of the increase will probably be passed on to employees, which has been the trend at an increasing rate over the last few years. There was a lot of discussion about this at the committee, and I think some members definitely think that it is likely to still be higher than this.
For comparison, Ms. Ames, could you give the approximate state anticipated rates? for, or can you provide that to the committee?
What for the state rates, what I can tell you is that this year for 05, it is a 16% increase. I would add that because state employees didn't get salary increases this time, there was a sense that perhaps the governor was willing to agree to fund the increases in health benefits this year, but PAB is definitely looking at ways to reduce that in the next contract. As far as I know, there's no real information yet about what those initial contract bids are going to look like.
Any additional? Please go ahead.
And just as we'll look at some numbers on the last page, but the difference between a 12% increase a year in health benefits versus a 16% increase a year is $80 million. So these are very significant assumptions in terms of dollars.
Yeah.
Page 6, the PERS and the OPSERP, the new retirement system rates. We assumed when we built the budget that we're currently at 11.11% of payroll, that would go up to 15.09, which was the estimate from PERS back in the fall. As you have heard, I'm sure there's currently some uncertainty about that and some concern that it will increase more than that. And we'll know at the late February board meeting. That PERS did decide that the additional increase they were expecting would be phased in over 2 years, which we're hoping brings it in relatively close to what we've already assumed. But here again, a lot of dollars are driven by this. A 1% increase from, say, 15 up to 16 is $40 million of cost to the state school fund.
Excuse me.
Yes,
sure.
Senator Walker.
Can you repeat that, please, Ms. Ames? 1% increase equals what?
About $40 million cost.
Thank you.
Ms. Ames, I'm pretty sure that probably all members of the committee know this, but school districts, given the nature of the work that they perform, approximately what percentage on average is personnel costs in school districts?
Mr. Chair, between 80 and 85% is cost of personnel in districts, and that's been pretty consistent over a long period. The only change we're really seeing is as school districts contract out some things like janitorial services or school bus drivers, you're not seeing those as direct personnel, although indirectly you're still paying for people in contracts. Then the last couple of cost drivers, inflation on services and supplies, is a relatively small cost driver since only about 15% of their budget is in that area.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Ames, percentage of the personnel cost is being reduced by contracting services. I would really be interested in, you know, some examples or how widespread that is. Hopefully the school boards are looking at that as areas that they should consider. I know our school district has looked at contracting out bus services and studied that tremendously. So, you know, if you could give us some examples of where that is being done, or Mr. West could maybe, or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, yeah, I would need to work with Department of Ed. They may have some ideas, or with COSA and those folks to get a better handle on what do the bigger districts have. I know the stories I've heard is Portland School District with their janitorial services, and not everyone would agree that was completely successful, I think. So they might be interested to hear a discussion of sort of what have districts felt like worked well and didn't.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So I would, you know, ask you, is that something we should be looking at as a Ways and Means Committee, and successes and failures? Or
I would believe so, particularly since we may look to some degree later at transportation costs in districts. Yeah. And so that may be an issue that comes up. I would ask in terms of that examination, though, that we look broadly at it, because at least there's anecdotal evidence of some school districts preliminarily having savings, actually getting rid of their rolling stock, and then when they're coming back to renew their contracts, getting much higher rates to renew than they had anticipated when they originally made the decision, and seeing a goodly portion of their savings evaporate or completely disappear. Yes.
Chair Devlin,
Senator Whitsett.
Ms. Ames, going back to page 5, you have a bullet point there, other salaries, and you kind of went over that quickly. It appears, and you know, that we have more non-teacher employees than we do teacher employees in the Department of Education, and perhaps we should focus a little more on how those salaries are affecting our budget and how they drive the whole Department of Education budget analysis.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, we can get you more breakdown too, if that would be helpful. What percentage of dollars? What percentage of people? And what sort of assumptions?
Thank you. That would be very helpful.
Okay. Senator Whitsett, I can assure you that I think that data will be available, because having served on the committee, you're getting like 1/100th. of the amount of paperwork and data that we receive. So I'm pretty sure they'll be able to provide that data.
Thank you.
Finally, the last cost driver increase in numbers of students, which includes the growth in weights, as was discussed yesterday. And again, these are very, very low by historic standards. Even with all of the weights and the changing demographics, we're forecasting a less than a 0.5% increase per year, and that compares to the last number of years at between 1% and 1.5% a year. Finally, then on page 7, you get to the nitty-gritty of the numbers, which so you can have a sense of which of these cost drivers really makes the most difference in terms of dollars. You do see we start with state and local resources. We apply these various assumptions and forecasts on cost drivers. And so you can go through and see health benefits is actually the single highest driver, and that's at assuming a 12% increase a year. And as I said, it goes up fairly quickly from there. PERS also a very large cost driver, about the same as total salary increase. So you get down to sort of the total dollars needed to continue current programs at $7.8 billion, and then subtract what our forecast for the local revenue will be to get down to a bottom line, what does the state need to supply to fund at the current program, which is a little over $5.3 billion. And as you well know, the governor's budget funded this at $5 billion, or a little over $300 million, short of being able to continue current program. And remembering Senator Devlin's question about sort of the governor didn't fund PERS, it certainly is the case in the state school fund that the governor did not fund all these cost drivers. But, of course, what we really know has to happen, because most of their costs are personnel, that's where the cuts have to come, whether it's in numbers of teachers, numbers of other kinds of staff, or numbers of school days. The schools will not have enough to pay for all those people. And that's the only real place they have to take those kind of reductions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative March, then Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda, the inflation on services and supplies, if we're looking at about 15% of the budget, I figured out it's close to a little under 3% as your inflation factor. And that seems awfully low for educational materials and textbooks and things like that. Because anecdotally, you go into any bookstore for educational books, and they've jumped higher than that. Is there any kind of measures out there that sort of track those kinds of costs?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, that is an area of concern to the committee, and I think rightly so. Although it may not drive a huge number of dollars, it's pretty clear we have not explicitly looked at individual drivers, and the concerns are energy and books as well, and energy being related to the transportation costs in particular. We've used the same inflation factors that state agencies use, which probably in some cases isn't enough for them either. But I think it's one of the areas that over the next 2 years we need to improve, is either to look for some specific indicators, but the other thing we have is with the DBI information, we can look at past trends and get some idea of where those kind of costs may be going. We've tended to focus so far on personnel costs and methodology, but I know a number of members were concerned that this is being understated and wouldn't really fund the real costs out there.
Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ames, sometime late last night or maybe early this morning, I think I left the building about 12:30, I was reading the governor's report on education. And something struck me last night, and it just struck me now as you were talking about how the governor didn't fund all the cost drivers in the state school fund. One of the things that he said in the report was that funding education at the level we need to is a luxury we can't afford. I thought that was really an odd thing to say, and perhaps you could explain what he meant by that.
Mr. Chair,
slowly twisting in the wind.
I think that the hardest thing for the governor in developing this budget was that I think he honestly does have a true commitment to education, but at the same time he had to see the programs that were being cut out of human services, and that made a dynamic where he felt like, well, his first commitment really is to education, and that is what in the long run needs to be funded in the state, that he couldn't cut any deeper into the safety net in human services. And I know it's hard to see this in the numbers, but I was looking back this morning at, as we build budgets, one of the things that we use to help to understand kind of what funding levels are at is we go through this process for each budget of sort of what does it cost to continue the current program level, current service level, or this time we called it a central budget level. And in human services, that current service level was very high for two reasons. They have very high cost drivers because, for instance, health plan with the medical costs. And second, they had a lot of one-time revenue to replace with general fund, including federal fiscal relief and tobacco settlement money, and some decline in tobacco tax. So if you look at sort of what it costs to continue current program in human services, we funded that about 10% below what it would cost to continue current service. Education we funded as a whole, not just K-12. About 5% below what we estimated it would cost to continue current service. So even though a lot of dollars are there in human services, and on one glance you feel like maybe the priority wasn't really given to education like you would hope it would be, from the governor's perspective, I think he really did have a commitment to education. But, of course, he would be the first to say, if you can come up with more dollars for education, I think he would support that.
That's not what he said.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Ames, I put you on the spot. Deservedly so. You're here representing the governor's office. And I just know that
Senator Walker, not to interrupt, but... You'll actually have the direct representative probably on Thursday. Mr. Sager will be here from the governor's office. So please. proceed.
Yes, well, thank you. I won't be here Thursday, but I will be getting the tape and listening to them in the car. We're trying to find more money for education, and I'm just trying to understand where the governor's coming from in the sense that I had last night reading that document that was a basic good education somehow seems to be a luxury in the state, and that just didn't really sit very well with me. But be that as it may, all ears on the rest of your presentation. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Jensen and Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and excuse the ignorance of the apparently newest member of the committee. Looks like we're upside down about $411.5 million on this. But I see in the we have no inclusion here, or am I missing it, of any other or federal funds that might be. Where does this fit in, or doesn't it? I guess just a.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the federal funds are not included here. This is explicitly the state school fund, which just equalizes the local and the state. The federal funds do come through the Department of Ed's budget in grant and aid. And so that's where we really saw that discussion.
If I could follow then with that, am I going to see when we look at the budgeted amounts here, the total amounts going to education, some increases someplace, they're going to offset those additional dollars that are federal dollars that are not included here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are some increases in federal funds, but again, as the Chair has pointed out, they are for certain schools, for certain students, for certain needs, and unlike the state school fund, can't be used just as general operating across the board. So while there are some additional dollars, they're not as flexible as these dollars.
I think in general, Representative Jensen, the problem is they can't be used directly to make up the shortfall because they don't go to the same purposes. I was trying to think of an analogy for Representative Wisnett, and I was going to use one of his air. It was like he had a base with B-52s, and he needed maintenance dollars for the B-52s, and they just gave him more F-16s. That's maybe not a great analogy.
It might be we don't get the same payload, but we might get it there faster.
Good point.
That was really quick. Representative Jensen, have you?
Well, you'll excuse me. We'll see this whole budget play out more, and my answers will come as I look at it further at the budget venture.
Representative March, then Representative Wisnett.
Okay, and I think the senator down there is interested, too. I just wanted to clarify that none of this includes any local options or local revenues other than the property tax. Those other funds, like local options, are outside of this formula, and whether, like some districts, I know they're in a cycle where they're getting ready to go away, aren't reflected here.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Not entirely. Because you just said local property taxes.
It includes local property taxes here, but
right,
not the
but
local
it also it probably includes well, that are within the formula some forest receipts.
Hmm. Oh.
Yeah, because those are inside the formula.
Wow. Right. And of course, it includes Common School Fund.
Right. Okay.
It hasn't been enacted.
No, but it includes existing. For instance, like the school district that we had yesterday that was, I can't remember, I think in Tillamook County, mm-hmm. actually has some cool. substantial forest receipts. So.
From state or federal?
I'm not sure. I just know it's substantial because they don't get any state assistance. So.
There
let's
is.
See.
There is both state and federal timber receipts in the local revenue.
Yeah. Representative Wisniff and Representative Whitsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Zanes, you stated the governor, in this difficult decision he had to make, said that it was basically 5% below current service level. But in his statements that he's made publicly, he said that he thought that the general fund amount of money would be offset by the increase in local property tax, and also Senator Representative Jensen, also an increase in federal money that would be coming in. Did your group, would you agree with that? And also, did your group, I've learned this, I have to get several questions in. So also, did your group discuss what little impact the court's decisions on PERS would do to this system, and how do we survive if it's the court's decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did not talk about PERS and what if we have dramatically higher increases, and obviously it's not just going to be a school issue, but a statewide issue. As far as the while there is a larger increase in local revenue than state revenue, there's a couple hundred million increase in local revenue compared to the current biennium. Well, I think there's about 80 million increase in state. Those two things are both considered in these calculations. So when we say we're 300 million short, the increase in the local revenue has already been considered. So while it is true that property taxes are growing, keep on chugging along, and we'll get some more money from it, we're still going to be short. As far as the federal revenues, it's certainly the increase in federal revenues will help. One of the key areas of federal revenues is for special education, which tends to be broadly distributed to most districts. But the other major increase in federal revenues is for Title I, and that only goes to certain schools. So in that case, it's much harder to think about the federal money offsetting the shortfall on the state side.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one thing. Linda had mentioned earlier about how we update information during the session. And one of the things that has come to light is that with the recently proposed budget by the president, that the federal revenues in the second year of our 05-07 biennium appear to be growing more slowly than what was originally anticipated in the governor's budget.
It's not good. Senator Whitsett and Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ames, first a comment. Looking over your figures, it seems that essentially the number of students is pretty flat, and the number of personnel that are hired by the Department of Education are pretty flat, or maybe the number of teachers are decreasing. Yet the cost of servicing the wages or the salaries of those people has gone up, by my figures here, $530 million, about almost half $1 billion per biennium. So it would certainly seem that you've identified where the cost driver is. Yes, the question, do you ever tabulate or quantify the fees that the various schools and school districts charge the students and the parents, and do you take that into consideration at all in your overall costs of education?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we in this group have not worked with sort of the other funding sources that are out there in schools, although with the DBI there is information on local option and those kind of local revenues from fees, but in this group we have not explicitly dealt with that piece of the school funding picture.
Thank you.
One thing I might comment on before going to Representative Jensen is that this committee obviously did not see the governor's budget prior to December 1st. I don't think too many people other than the governor's budget people and the budget management people saw the budget prior to. So when we were doing this, we were actually obviously not knowing what the governor would propose. We were basically making, the whole purpose of the committee is to make a recommendation to the governor on what should be the level of funding to continue existing programs. So, Representative Jensen.
I think as I have recorded things, I've answered my own questions.
One thing, Ms. Ames, to be fair on this, in terms of the governor being in a very difficult position, and I have to be fair about this in the sense of we constantly talk in this building about the trade-off between public safety and human resources, or human resources and education, and we seldom talk about actually what I think are the sort of 800-pound gorillas in each one of those areas. It's a nice gorilla in education, but the 800-pound gorilla in education is K-12. In public safety, it's corrections. And in human services, it's health care. And when you look at that, probably at least half of the human resources budget is health care, not even including the employees' health care costs. And you look at our rate of inflation in health care, you can clearly see how health care is the biggest driver in that entire budget. And also you can see the reality that we can't afford 12, 14, or 16% increases in health care for any prolonged period of time. It's not sustainable. And the concern I have actually in human resources is that their health care is very important, but there are other important things in human resources. And I see sometimes health care actually pushing out those other things that I think are important also, like child protection and things of that nature. So there are drivers, I think, within all of these budgets. So, and of course, one of the realities, too, in terms of health care is that although the roll-up was much higher, I mean, the first reaction basically is to we've dropped the standard population to probably going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 24, 25,000 now, and funded outside the general fund. But I look at some of the budget drivers, and I look at the time when we transferred over from a Medicaid to the Oregon Health Plan. I saw one of the budgets, and our Medicaid expenses at that time, general fund expenses, were $49
million. $800
million? And that doesn't include, that's just the general fund. That doesn't include all the cigarette taxes going to it. So, thank you very much for your presentation, and we will go on to Mr. Reeder.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Your comments are really illustrative, because I think one of the ways that we're supposed to find more money for education here is going to be looking at these cost drivers and how we can reduce those cost drivers and increase the budget.
I think it's, Senator Walker, I think that's very true. I think it's also very difficult.
Well, I agree, because some of these are beyond our control. But, when I heard you talk about health care costs, there is a bill floating around upstairs in the policy committees on group health insurance, offering it instead of through the School Boards Association and others, offering one central source for that. And I know that's a sore spot, and people think it saves money and it doesn't. But I don't think we should not look at that, because we need to find ways to cut costs.
Well, I think actually all the parties in the room know that if that bill comes out of the policy committee, this is the committee where it ends up.
Yeah. As well as the ESD reorganizations that we're looking at, too. So
so you have lots to look forward to. Mr. Reeder.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Reeder, Director of Policy Research and Analysis Section at the Department of Education. What I would like to do today is really address or talk about two things. The first is the database initiative, what we call the DBI. Database initiative is really the guts of the data collection process at the Department of Education. And then the second thing is to give you a brief look at the mechanics of the quality education model. We've talked a number of times about sort of the purpose of the model and what the model says about required funding levels, but we really haven't demonstrated how the model really works on the ground, and I'd like to do that a little bit today and also indicate to you that I'm happy to provide each of you with a copy of the model so that you can play with it and use it yourselves, and I'm also happy to give you a one-on-one tutorial if you would like me to do that. The model really is a pretty powerful tool to look at funding issues. It's not just about the big number. It is a tool which can be of value to policymakers. With that, I'm going to launch right into the database initiative. That process started 6 or 7 years ago. It really had three primary goals. The first was to make the data that the Department of Education collects about education more consistent across schools and school districts. And we do that in a number of ways, a number of things we're doing to make that data more consistent. The second was to provide training to districts in the way they gather the data that they give to us to make sure that it's of high quality and that it, again, that it's consistent across districts. And the third was to make the collection of that data much more efficient by using web-based tools to collect that data. And those tools really accomplish all of the goals, which is it makes it much more efficient and cheaper to get that data out of districts and into the Department of Education. It also makes the data more accurate because those web-based tools also can do a lot of internal checking of the data before it arrives at the department, so the data is much cleaner when it gets to the department than it was in the past. What I'd like to do right now, I'm going to go online and I'm going to give you a flavor of the kind of data that we collect. These are standard reports that have been on the web for the last 5 or 6 years, really from the beginning of the database initiative process. They provide some basic information about schools and districts in the state, and they really represent the tip of the iceberg in the sense of the data that we have available to us. They are a presentation of the data. The underlying data is in much more detail, and we can provide that detail to you if you like. I'm starting here on the Department of Education's homepage. To get to the DBI tables, first go to Reports, and then to SFDA Reports. And this is really what I would call the portal to the DBI tables on the website, and they're in a number of categories here. Funding, profiles, which I will go to first, which really give a snapshot of conditions in districts and schools in the state. And I'm just going to go out right now to, as you can see, we have a number of different tables here. The first one, which I find very useful, is what we call the district profile. Allows you to choose a year for the data you want to look at, and I'm going to choose 0203 because much of this data is financial data, and we're in the process of getting the 0304 data in place, but it's not complete yet. So the 0203 year is the one for which we have complete financial data. Once you've chosen a year, then you can choose a district, and I'll just sort of grab one at random here, and then you can view the report. And so this really gives you a really nice snapshot of overall situation in a particular district. Student enrollment, this first line here, that's the definition, the October 1 student count that I talked about yesterday, and then average daily membership also we report here. Number of special ed students, ESL students, so forth, different categories of students. in this particular district. The center column here, or the center and the right-hand columns, show a comparison of this particular district to statewide averages. And for example, if you look at the third line special ed students, 12.2% of the students in this district are identified as special ed, and that compares to 12.9% statewide. So it really puts this district in the context of the state. We scroll down here, we show dropout rates for the district and the state, staffing levels for the district, and then compares the distribution in that district of the different categories to the distribution for the state as a whole. Really is a nice context for comparing individual districts to conditions in the state as a whole. Provides, and this data is not available as yet, information on household incomes, other information about the community in which this district is located. And then we get...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Reeder, you get that information from the Census Bureau. I don't imagine you're asking the parents for that information.
Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, that's correct. We get this information from the Census Bureau, and these particular collections done by the Census, these are the collections that where the data that they make public is a little bit further down the line in their process.
Mm-hmm.
And so the income-based data hasn't, I believe it is just recently available from the Census Bureau, but we haven't gotten it loaded into our system yet, which is why it doesn't appear here. But we are working to get that updated.
Thank you.
Then we also show some of the financial data for the district. This is expenditure data on a per student basis. The definition here is operating expenditures. It does not include any capital expenditures. And we present it both as the general fund portion of their spending and then all of their operating funds, which would include general fund, all federal funds, and any funds they get from their enterprises, such as food service.
Representative Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeder, explain, so that school is spending $5,100 per student, but the state average is $6,000. Is that correct?
Chair Devlin, Representative Whitson, that's correct. This is a school district, so this is a district-wide average for all the schools in that district.
So where did the $900, where did they, I'm losing $900 or $800?
Chair Devlin, Senator Wisden, I think you can get some clues to why this district has less money than the statewide average if you go back up to the characteristics
right.
of their students. They have fewer special ed students, so they get less money in that regard. No ESL students, so they don't get money for ESL students.
Thank you. I understand.
What did they have in terms of subsidized lunch? Were they?
Chair Devlin.
That number should.
Yeah. We don't present that data on this district profile. When we get into the school profile,
okay.
that information is available at individual school level. It's
okay.
probably something we should add to this district report, but we do have it on the school level report.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. This is nice to have this information, but I'm mentally putting what's nice and what's necessary. Why is this necessary? I mean, how does this actually affect a child? How would it affect my child or my grandchildren? I mean, I would rather have the money go into the classroom rather than collect all this data. I'm having a hard time with this concept. It's wonderful. It's nice to have this. It gives you a nice thing. But how does it actually help education? How does it help my child?
Mr. Reeder, do you
have... Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, I guess I would reiterate the response to that Superintendent Castillo gave you, and that is if you're going to run an operation or run an enterprise that spends upwards of $8 billion in a biennium, you need to understand how well that operation is running, and to do that you need to collect data.
Just to follow me, in my sense is, okay, the data might show that we should spend $900 more per student there, but there might be $900 that by collecting this data. I'm just still having a problem with this, because, I mean, we're going to have to make some hard decisions here. You know, I'm saying, where do I want this money to go? I would rather go to the classroom. That's where I'm coming from.
Mr. Reeder, this is not really a response, but I think part of it is that, A, that our data collection requirements from the federal government are pretty extensive, at least my understanding of them. The other portion of that is, though, is that I think there is going to be some interest in looking at, and I know that the department is looking at that, of looking at ways so that you don't have duplicative reports from school districts in terms of trying to make things more uniform or condensed so that you don't have to enter the same data over again in another report that you've already sent in, because that is an issue that you hear from superintendents, is the multiple number of reports that you have to put in to meet both the needs of the Department of Ed and probably federal requirements also. So.
Chair Devlin, you know, that's correct. First, Senator Nelson, pretty much all of this data that we collect is required of us by the federal government. So we're required to collect this and send this to the U.S. Department of Education. And as Chair Devlin indicated, we are working very hard at the department to reduce duplication in our collections and the database initiative by making the collection web-based and electronic. It really is allowing us to do that, where we can link up information received in one collection, for example special ed information, with information collected on student enrollments and expenditures, link those up electronically so we only have to ask for them once.
I guess it's the only question. Then, how many FTEs do you have to operate this system?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, I don't have that number. We have one FTE that deals with the financial data. We have two FTE that collect student level data. Student counts, ADM, those sorts of things for the formula. And then we have a number of programmers who support the electronic data collection effort and the creation of the website tables and so forth. In terms of a total number of FTE, I don't have an answer for you today, but I certainly can get that for you.
Just a follow-up on that. Part of your operating budget, you have $50 million coming from federal monies. Does that go to help pay some of these people, or how does that $50 million in operating costs from the federal government fit into this whole process?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, I'm not the best person to answer that question. I'm sure Mr. West can either answer that or get an answer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brett West, Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Administration. Senator Nelson, we can certainly get that information for you. We'll bring that back to you next time we talk to you about that.
Please proceed.
Just to quickly finish up with this district profile table, as we get further down, we show number of instructional days in the district compared to the statewide average, and some information about technical infrastructure available in the schools, computers per student, internet connections, and then information on student performance at the bottom of the table. So these profiles are really a snapshot of a broad range of data about a school district. We also have similar information at the school level, and I'll just do this very quickly. It allows you to pick a year again, pick a district, and then within a district, pick a school, and provides similar information. It compares the school to the district that it resides in, and then to some statewide numbers, again providing staffing information, financial information, and student performance information.
Mr. Reeder, I know that you have a planned presentation here, but there was somewhere on here, and I don't know if it's on this page, where you show the inventory of the age of schools in the state. Is that somewhere easily accessible on here?
Chair Devlin, I don't believe that's still on the website.
Okay. Yeah, I looked at it about a month or two ago. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Mr. Reeder, do you have, I don't know if the Department of Education has oversight over this, but do you know if education service districts have to comply with some similar program or this program to indicate how they spend their money and where their revenues?
Yeah. Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, yes, we get the same information from ESDs that we get from school districts. We get their fully audited financial statements electronically in the same breakdown that we get from school districts.
So, Ms. Chair, could I find this on the web then?
Yes, you can, and I will point that out to you in a moment here.
Oh, okay. And I know tomorrow, I believe we're having some discussion on...
Tomorrow, Senator Walker, we're going to have a relatively compact discussion on ESDs, and also Mr. Meyer from Legislative Revenue is going to do a more detailed presentation on the school formula.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Reeder.
At this point, what I will do is get into some of the financial information that the department collects. We do this in two ways. There's two different collections is what we call them. We get budget information from districts, and that is their spending plan for the coming year. We collect this electronically as well. And just as an example here, this first table shows budgeted information by fund and function. And here you can see that we have this information. On the top list is school districts, and the bottom list here is ESDs. So that information is available both for districts and ESDs. Let's just pick an ESD here. And it shows their expenditure information. This is a Clackamas ESD, broken down by up here the general fund, and then within the general fund, the functions that they spend that general fund money on.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
Does this show the average Oregonian who's looking at this what Clackamas ESD, what districts they represent?
Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, if we go back to the profile page, we do have an ESD profile.
Okay.
And it will show the districts that are within the umbrella of each ESD.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
So that's the budget side of things. We also collect from financial audits that are done after the school year is over, both revenue and expenditure information, and we'll just look at the quickly at the revenue side of things. Again, I'll just pick a district here, and it shows one quirk of this: you have to turn off the ESDs, or you get all of them first. So I picked the Ashland School District, and it will show the source of operating revenue for the Ashland School District: local revenue, county ESD revenue, state revenue, federal revenue, and then a total. And again, that information is available for ESDs as well. Then on the expenditure side, probably the most common information that we're asked for is expenditures by fund and function. So again, it's available for both districts and ESDs, and I'll just grab a district here. Here shows what they actually spent, and contrast this earlier with their budget. It's the same level of detail. You know, what fund they spend the money from, or in the case of a budget where they plan that spending, and then broken down by the functions on which they intend to spend it,
Mr. Chair, on which they actually spend it. Thank you, sir. Mr. Reeder, does it have the construction bonds and expense in that? We get that in this data bank?
Mm-hmm. Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, yes, we do have that information. This is by fund. If you get down to Fund 300, you'll see debt service payments, and Fund 400 will be capital projects payments with a breakdown of where, you know, what activities those monies were spent on.
Mr. Reeder, I don't know if anyone will get to this detail, but you might explain one of the things that you'll see in school districts now is when you see PERS costs, you'll have to look at PERS costs and also in many cases at their bonded costs also, because many of them have sold bonds to basically to cover part of their PERS liability and reduce their overall cost. So to actually figure out what they are paying in terms of public employee retirement costs, you have to look at both. So it gets a little bit deceptive.
Chair Devlin, that is correct, and we worked very hard with districts to make sure that their audits portrayed those expenditures in a meaningful way. And what we asked them to do is, if they did prepay their PERS by borrowing, that lump sum payment to the PERS system would not show up as a current year operating expenditure, because that would show a giant blip in a single year, but instead to show that as either a special fund or as a debt service payment, and then to reflect the annualized amount in their operating funds so that we did capture it properly in their operating funds.
Representative, follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeder, I understand some schools have negotiated with the teachers to provide retired medical benefits. Where would that show up? What code is that, or what?
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, if the district is paying for the medical care of retired teachers, that would show up as a payment for medical benefits. We also have a separate category for early retirement payments, but those would be really, in a sense, salary paid after retirement, sort of a post-paid salary, but the medical benefits portion of it would show up as medical benefits payments.
Thank you. Is that legal, Mr. Chair? Is there any problems with that?
I feel like Ms. Ames here. I think there are some outstanding issues with that. The general direction that I think school districts are going, just having talked to school districts, is that they are going away from... there is an issue, I believe, in state statute, and I can't... maybe somebody can respond. I better back up. They see it as a sore point, I'll probably put it that way, in the sense that if you do comparisons between how different employees are treated, and I'll have to be fair here, school employees largely participate in their health insurance. By comparison, most state employees do not participate in the cost of their health insurance other than in co-pays and things. School districts, though, have historically in some cases, not all cases, provided, and I'm not the person to answer this really, in some cases have provided health care benefits to retirees between their age of retirement and the time that they would be eligible for other benefits. That is quite a bit different from what you've seen for most public employees in the state. And so I think there are people that have looked at that issue and said that that is something that needs to be addressed. And I don't know, we're not really in, I don't know who would hear would be, who I should put on the point to talk about this. There,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. There is a statutory requirement that school district and other local government retirees be kept in the active group for purposes of their post-employment health insurance premiums. That is, these retirees are rated based on the larger active group.
Can I clarify there what you're... This is the other side of the issue, and that is that retirees are part of the group. There's a separate issue that some school districts have provided actual insurance coverage.
That's correct. After an employee retires, some school districts have made arrangements through their collective bargaining agreements to continue to pay all or a portion of the retired employee's health insurance up until they reach Medicare age. And many school districts are realizing the expense of that. They got into these arrangements when health care costs were relatively lower or more stable, and now they're realizing how expensive it's getting, and they're trying to negotiate their way out of those early retirement agreements.
Is it legal?
I believe, Mr. Marshall, it is legal. Whether it's wise now is probably a different question.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It is legal.
Sorry to put you on this.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's just so handy-dandy to always have a lobbyist here to answer those tricky questions.
Mr. Reeder.
Just like to show you one more thing on the financial side. I showed you expenditures by function, and I characterize those as the things that school districts do. Now I will show it to you by object, which is what school districts buy. And this is also very useful information. We'll get a different district this time. Breaks it down by salaries, associated payroll costs, purchase services, supplies, sort of the things that districts buy to run a district. And so we have it broken down both ways, what they do and what they buy. And so those two things together provide a very detailed and rich data set.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Jensen.
If you stay with that... that you had there a minute, you go to classification of categories as far as salaries are concerned. In terms of administration, managerial, it's managerial classified, it's a little difficult to read. Is there uniformity in the definitions and the reporting of this by school districts across the state, or is this... who is and who is not in administration a locally determined number?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, we work very hard to get consistent definitions that all the districts will use. We work with district personnel offices, we work with district business offices, and we also work with the auditors, the independent auditors, that do the audits on school districts to make sure that they're using the same definitions. We think that the data continues to get better each year because we give training to districts on how to define things and how to report things, and we also are available to, when they have questions about the appropriate way to categorize either expenditures or staff, that we're available to answer those questions. So do we have perfect agreement across all districts? Probably not. But we're working to make the data better, and we think we're getting better each year as we get more experience under our belts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please go on.
In addition to the financial data, we also have data. Well, actually, let me back up just one moment. I believe it was yesterday we were asked to provide a breakdown of expenditures by district by spending category. I mentioned that we were putting that on the web. That table is available, was put on the web yesterday morning. You may recognize this table as the same one that was provided by COSA. I was the source of that table, and so the table is now here on the web. It shows operating expenditures by these functional categories for each district in the state. And so that's available to you on the web. I am also happy to provide that in a printed copy. And if you see anything there about the way the data is broken down that you would like more detail on, I'm also happy to provide that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Reeder, I'm assuming the training that was given to the school districts on how to report under this program helps them understand what goes into each category, so that remains pretty consistent and you don't find districts putting things in categories that don't belong there.
Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, that's correct. We do ongoing training. We do trainings every year to reinforce those concepts of consistency and adhering to the definitions that exist for how to report.
All right, thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Senator Devlin, Mr. Reeder, do you do any performance auditing to find out, in fact, they do it right?
Mr. Reeder.
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitson, the Department of Education does not, at this time, do performance audits on school districts to see if they are adhering to those guidelines. We rely very heavily on the independent auditors that districts hire to audit their financial records and their student records, and we work very closely with those auditors to make sure that we're using consistent definitions. But at this time, we do not do performance audits.
Senator Whitson.
The district auditors are financial auditors, not performance auditors. Is that correct?
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitson, they typically are auditors with CPA firms. They may be qualified to do performance audits, but I do not believe that, from the department's perspective, we do not ask them to do performance audits of districts. Districts may ask them to do that for them, but our primary interest is in the auditing of their financial statements and their student accounting systems, so that we get accurate accounts of their both their financial circumstances and their students.
Senator Nelson, or Senator Whitson.
One more, please.
Yes.
Would performance auditing be helpful for the Department of Education to determine if, in fact, the districts were adhering to your principles and your direction?
Chair Devlin, I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that question. Would more scrutiny of school districts lead to better, more accurate processes in the districts? I think some of the lessons we've learned with the Union Baker ESD suggest that may not be a bad idea. At the point, I don't believe the department has the authority to do performance audits, but I wouldn't be the best person to answer that question.
Thank you, Mr. Reeder.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this show me students per teacher ratio, or do you have that some other place?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, yes, it will. Back on the profiles page, that is one of the pieces of information that we provide.
That's statewide. Would there be a statewide average? Or?
Oh, well, let me show it to you very quickly here. We go to the school profile. Right here is a student-teacher ratio for the school and for the district, and since this district only has one school, they are the same. This is a very small district, and then the statewide average over here.
I asked, and you were going to bring me some information on FPEs, I guess. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking of these figures that at some point I think there's like 450 employees at the Department of Education. Some of those go for school blind and deaf and that sort of thing. Am I right with this? 252 or something employees in the Department of Education, of which 46 are managers. Is that, am I someplace in the area with those things?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Brett West. Senator Nelson, you are correct in the ballpark. We have about 254 employees in the Department of Education. As we mentioned last week, 46 of them are management service. We have an additional about 150 employees in the state schools for the blind and deaf, and another 29 in youth corrections.
Okay. I guess, you know, my point here is all this is that, you know, the ratio of managers to employees is pretty high. I think it's like 1-5 or something like that. And in one of our earlier presentations, Senator Morris brought up that fact of, you know, that there was a 1-8. I mean, it looks to me like a lot of this is collecting data. You know, how many managers do you need to collect data? I just don't understand the process, and that's what I'm trying to get to. Why do you need all these people to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I think that's a really good question. When we look at that, first off, when we look at the 46 management service employees, that's for the entire 440 employees in the entire enterprise, education, the special schools, and youth corrections. So we're roughly at about 1-6, or 1-10 for the management ratio. Many of those managers have responsibilities for other things outside of data collection, as I'm sure you're aware. But I think maybe the best thing for us to do might be to just sit down with you and kind of walk you through our organizational chart and show you where the responsibilities fall for data collection, data analysis, data reporting, and give you a good idea of exactly what it is we do to make sure that the public and you and the federal government knows how the money is being spent, where it's being spent, and what the outcomes for that are.
Sure, just a comment. I mean, when I look at these budgets, I think it's going to be very difficult for us to, at any point, to cut any of the monies that's going actually right out to the school districts. The only place I see for us to find any savings is in the operation budgets, and I just don't know enough about the operations to say whether this management scheme is the best scheme or not. So that's what I'm trying to get to.
Mr. Reeder, why don't we just actually continue with this portion of your presentation today, and would you be available Thursday to do the quality education model?
Chair Devlin, yes, I would be happy to do that on Thursday.
One of the things I might note is I had some concerns when we were putting forward this schedule, whether we would be able to fill the time, because I did not know if we'd have enough questions from the committee to fill the time. That does not seem to be a problem.
We're going to mess
up. Please proceed. And
okay, Chair Dell, I think I can probably finish in about 5 minutes, with the understanding that there should not be any more questions.
I won't give you that guarantee.
Just to finish up here, we also have staffing information on our website, which shows, and we break this down a number of different ways, what we call certificated staff are would be any staff requiring a certificate. Those would be teachers and administrators. And we have basic information broken down by gender and ethnicity for those employees. This just gives you a flavor of the kind of information we have on those employees. We also have information broken down instructional staff, so this would be teachers primarily. And then also non-instructional staff, which would be classified staff, and let me just open one of these up to give you a sense for how that looks. Broken down for a given district, broken down by school, shows the types of staff. First starts out with a count of the students in the district to give you a sense for the size of the district. Total non-instructional staff, and then what categories they would fall into, guidance counselors, administrators, so forth. And then also gives you a student to non-instructional staff ratio. And just to clarify, these staff, which total, as Senator Whitsitt pointed out, roughly 54,000 employees, those are not employees of the Department of Education. Those are all employees of individual school districts and ESDs. None of those 54,000 would be employees of the department itself. And one further question that Senator Whitsitt asked in the context of the Revenue Forecast Committee when we talked about forecasting teacher salaries. The department does maintain a model that does that forecasting, and part of that model also includes forecasting salaries for administrators, superintendents, principals, assistant principals, as well as the wage levels of classified employees. So we do have a comprehensive look at the wage trends for all of those groups, not simply teachers.
One other clarification, Mr. Reeder, is that not to correct Ms. Ames, but what is the average number of potential steps that a school district has for teachers when you consider actually more?
More than 20?
Yeah.
I thought he testified to 20 a while ago.
Chair Dillon, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. It does vary from district to district.
Yeah.
You know, when you get in, they break it down by education level, by experience, and typically what we considered a step would be a year of experience, and they would range from, you know, 14 to 17, maybe as high as 20 steps. What we're also seeing recently is, you know, once a teacher has reached the top of the step scale, they typically don't, you know, their salary increases from that point on would typically be only cost of living increases. So in a 25-year career of a teacher, the final 10 years, they would not receive any step increases at all. But we have started seeing districts give things like longevity bonuses, which sort of start to look like a step increase in some sense. So it's a bit fluid out there. It's a matter of negotiations in the bargaining process. So but, you know, in the salary structures themselves, I think 15 to 17 is a typical number.
In the range, but I think actually, could Mr. Bennett or Mr. Marshall actually provide us just a sample of a school district in terms of, because of the, you look both at the range and the credit that's given for educational level and all of that, and you'll see that it is actually, teachers can fit within, in many cases, 40 different blocks on that schedule.
Chair Devlin, that's correct. If you would consider each education level as a separate set of steps, then each district has on the order of, you know, 60 to 100 individual steps that a teacher could fit into.
Please proceed.
Okay, I'll just finish here with the final set of tables, what we call school processes, and this is where we provide class size information, and I'll just look at the elementary class size information here. Get in the higher range of the alphabet here.
Eugene.
Okay, we'll look at Eugene. For each school within the district, we show the enrollment, and then within each grade range, the average class size. And as you can see, you know, kindergartners often are lower. The kindergarten class sizes are often lower. But as you get into the elementary grades, 24, 26 in this school, up to 30 in this elementary school. If you look at these, I mean, we do have a number of years here. If you look at these over time, I think what you'll find is that those average sizes in most schools have crept up in the last 3 or 4 years by 2 or 3 students, even more per classroom. So we are seeing a general trend in larger class sizes in the state, just about everywhere. With that, I will answer any further questions you may have, and look forward to Thursday to talk about the QEM.
Just for demonstration cases and not to make any point, can you do the descending local share for districts on this?
Local share of?
Revenue. Showing what percentage of revenue comes from a
revenue
local level.
By source. It's sorted it by dollar amount, not percent. We may not have, well,
he gave it.
Said percent. Well, we may have a bug here.
Okay. I've done it by percent before, so okay. It's. I was just wanted to point out something that might surprise people, and I wasn't going to point out. I have some districts that are actually relatively high local level, but one of the relatively high local levels is the sister school district. Another is Neocony on the coast. So it's pretty hard to make generalizations that are universal throughout the state of how much revenue is coming locally versus from the state.
Sisters has a local option tax in addition to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Provides about $70,000.
Yeah. So maybe it's just not working. I hate to give you an example where your system isn't working, but
it always happens.
Well, any additional questions for Mr. Reeder? With that, thank you very much for your presentation, and we will have a little bit of extra time today to go back to our offices and.
Oh my gosh!
And we will adjourn until 8:30 tomorrow morning.
Gone home at midnight.
Yeah.